from NPR and WBUR. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
And I'm Lisa Mullins. It's Here and Now. Today, President Biden meets with Asian American leaders in Atlanta after a gunman opened fire at three massage businesses there. Six of the eight people killed were women of Asian descent. Police arrested the only suspect. He's a 21-year-old white man who's said to have been a customer at two of the spas. Police have not determined a motive, but the violence comes amid a rise in hate crimes against Asian Americans. FBI Director Christopher Wray spoke about that in an exclusive interview with NPR National Justice Correspondent Carrie Johnson. Carrie, the Atlanta shootings are still under investigation, but tell us what Director Wray said about the FBI's work on it.
Wray told me the Bureau is playing a rather limited role for now, but that the incident really struck home with him. Here's what he had to say.
So, obviously, it's a heartbreaking incident, and it hits particularly close to home for me since I consider Atlanta home. And so I certainly grieve for the victims and their families. The FBI is supporting state and local law enforcement, specifically APD, the Atlanta Police Department, and the Cherokee County Sheriff's Office. So we're actively involved, but in a support role. And while the motive remains still under investigation, at the moment, it does not appear that the motive was racially motivated. But I really would defer to the state and local investigation on that for now.
And Lisa, important to note that Atlanta police say nothing is off the table when it comes to hate crimes charges.
So even if police are not linking the shooting to as a racially motivated matter of violence, it's still coming as hate crimes are on the rise. What did Director Wray have to say about that?
Yeah, the director told me he's been concerned about hate crimes for some time now and that he's done some work within the FBI to try to reach out to that Asian American and Pacific Islander community. Here's more from him.
Within our civil rights program, which is one of our top programs, hate crimes are the highest priority component of that and have been. In connection with the AAPI, the Asian American Pacific Islander community in particular, it's something we've been tracking, especially over the last year or so. And even since March of last year, we've done over 60 different outreach events with that community around the country.
And Lisa, I've learned that Attorney General Merrick Garland, the new Attorney General, also had an off-the-record meeting with representatives from the Asian American community earlier this week as well.
I want to switch, Carrie, to what happened on January 6th, because the FBI is still trying to get to the bottom of the insurrection at the Capitol. What updates did he give you on that?
He said it's an enormous investigation, something like 400 people charged so far, but they're not done yet. They're going to keep on digging. So far, the director said that they've seen some small conspiracies, but they continue to look further. And they have not yet seen evidence of a bigger national conspiracy, but he said they're going to keep digging.
One other issue, Christopher Wray was an appointee of Donald Trump. But the president soured on him. He made the FBI into his punching bag, according to some. Did Wray have anything to say about morale at the agency since Donald Trump left office?
Basically, the director told me he didn't pay any attention to former President Trump's mean tweets. But he did say this when I asked him about whether he had left a resignation letter just in case.
I guess all I would say is I'm a low-key guy. But nobody should mistake my demeanor for what my spine is made out of. And I made a commitment when I was nominated that I was going to do this job one way, by the book. And that's the way I've tried to approach it since day one. That's the way I'm going to continue to approach it.
And Lisa, the FBI director serves a 10-year term, so Chris Wray could be around another 6.5 years or so.
Okay. Speaking to FBI Director Christopher Wray, NPR National Justice Correspondent Carrie Johnson. Nice to talk to you. Thank you, Carrie.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Financial markets have been up and down this week as investors grow increasingly worried about inflation. That's partly because of President Biden's $1.9 trillion COVID relief plan. $1,400 checks are arriving in Americans' bank accounts, but some economists fear that between that stimulus and millions of Americans hopefully returning to work this summer, inflation will skyrocket to levels we haven't seen in decades. Geeta Gopinath is chief economist for the International Monetary Fund. Geeta, welcome.
Thanks, Peter. It's great to join you.
And why don't we define the fear that we're talking about here? It was the 1970s and 80s when the U.S. last experienced serious inflation, prices soared, and then so did interest rates in an effort to cool things down. What does a period of sustained inflation do to the economy?
The problem with inflation is that if you go to stores and if you see that the things that you typically buy, the prices of that are going up much faster than you expected, and your paychecks aren't keeping pace, then you're just going to have less purchasing power and you're not going to be able to buy as much. Obviously, it's bad for you in terms of your consumption, and it's also bad for the economy because the economy cannot maintain high levels of economic activity.
Well, some economists are warning that this huge injection of cash into the economy with the COVID relief bill could make this happen again. But the Fed chair, Jerome Powell, said this week that the risks are low. Here he is.
People start businesses. They reopen restaurants. The airlines will be flying again. All of those things will happen. And so it'll turn out to be a one-time sort of bulge in prices, but it won't change inflation going forward.
So Powell there saying that there will be a spike in prices, but that inflation would be temporary. What do you think?
I agree with him. If you look at the evidence from the last three decades, that is where it would lead you to. And there are three main reasons for it, which is one is that there is a lot of slack in the U.S. labor market. So if you look at the number of unemployed Americans, that's around 10 million. In addition, there are 4 million who have left the labor force. So there is a lot of slack there. The second is that the sensitivity of inflation to slack has changed. You know, when unemployment was around 10% in 2009 and then dropped all the way to 3.5% in 2019, I mean, inflation barely moved. I mean, it stayed very stable. And a third factor is inflation expectations. If you look at what people expect inflation will be in 5 years or 10 years, it's very close to the 2% number. And so for these three sets of reasons, you would conclude that you're likely to see a transitory bump in inflation, but it's not going to last into the future.
My question is, how do you really know? Because people have pointed to the failed inflation predictions of 2009 during the Obama stimulus and the monetary policy of the Great Recession. That didn't happen. There was no inflation. But this is different. This stimulus is much larger. The economy is poised to open up again as the virus gets under control. Many people actually have quite a bit of savings built up over the past year. How can we trust the predictions that you just gave that inflation won't happen when we really haven't been in a situation like this before?
No, that's absolutely right. I think one has to have some humility there and say that these are extraordinary times. While there will be a period when people will want to kind of make up for the lost opportunities of the last year, that is transitory and that changes over time. So I think what I would watch out for, given the uncertainty, is what's happening with inflation expectations. And there is good data on that. If we see that inflation expectations are in fact going up in a way that we haven't seen over the last three decades, then that would be a cause for concern.
Why does that matter? And whose expectations are we talking about?
The reason this matters is because, for instance, if you expect prices to go up by 3% instead of 2%, then when you start negotiating paychecks, you're going to ask for a 3% raise and not a 2% raise. And when you automatically do that, then that's going to translate into higher wages of 3%, and then that's going to pass through some into prices, and inflation is going to go up. So it can become quite self-fulfilling.
I see. Is it possible that some economists aren't worried about inflation because they frankly haven't seen it in 40 to 50 years? It's sort of like the pandemic. We didn't think it would happen because no one could remember the last time it did 100 years ago.
Oh, that certainly could certainly be the case. I mean, if you listen to Chair Powell, you know, there is some of that impression you come away with, because he said that it's not enough for us to kind of forecast that inflation will be higher. We actually have to see it. That, to me, is a statement of the fact that they've spent a decade trying to get inflation perfectly up to target, and it hasn't worked. So, indeed, there is that bit of scarring, which is that until we see it, we're not going to believe it.
If the Fed thinks the bump in prices is temporary, and then it does turn out to be wrong for whatever reason, will it be too late to act, or does it just sort of adjust interest rates and everything goes back to normal?
The Fed does have tools, including raising interest rates. But it's not necessarily going to be smooth. If you have to raise interest rates very quickly, then that, you know, in the past has led to recessions. We could see inflation going up if it goes up persistently, but it's not like a very massive jump and then stays at a much higher level for a long time. You know, they would gradually raise interest rates and bring down inflation. And that would be more orderly as opposed to having to raise interest rates very quickly. I think that could be quite disorderly.
Geeta Gopinath is chief economist at the International Monetary Fund. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Peter.
Germany is the latest country to say it'll resume using the AstraZeneca vaccine for COVID-19. That follows yesterday's recommendation from the European Medicines Agency that the benefits of the vaccine outweigh the risks. More than a dozen countries suspended use of the AstraZeneca shot after a small number of those vaccinated developed blood clots. Spain, France, and Italy are among the countries also lifting their suspensions. NPR's Frank Langfitt joins us from outside London. Frank, we should note that the U.S. is not right now using the AstraZeneca vaccine, but the U.K., where you are, did not stop using the vaccine at all. The government, though, is still trying to convince people that it's safe, and Prime Minister Boris Johnson is leading that effort. How is he going about doing that?
Well, he's getting the vaccine himself, Lisa, and he's basically, particularly yesterday, he was essentially a pitch man for it. This is what he said.
So the Oxford jab is safe and the Pfizer jab is safe. The thing that isn't safe is catching COVID, which is why it's so important that we all get our jabs as soon as our turn comes.
And you said he's doing that now, or today anyway. Why is it necessary to send out the message that the AstraZeneca vaccine in particular is safe? How reluctant are people to get it?
I don't think they're that reluctant, but I think he wants to be careful given what happened in, you know, as you were talking about, in Europe in the last week or so. Actually, what's really interesting, Lisa, is vaccine positivity, which is how they refer to it here, is actually very high in the UK. If you go back to December, 78% people here felt positive about vaccines. It's now up to 95%, according to government polling. Most people that I know are happy to get it, looking forward to it. There has been some uptake questions with some of the Black and South Asian communities, but some really good outreach, particularly at mosques up in Birmingham and further north. And I think that what Johnson wants to do here is just make sure this vaccine train keeps rolling down the track.
Right, and that the supply keeps up. Is there enough vaccine to get into people's arms?
Up until now, there has been, and in fact, it's really striking. We got a big shipment here recently, and we could tell because our phones suddenly lit up. My wife and I, we got a note from the local National Health Service saying, come on in and get your injections. And it was clearly tied to the supply coming in. My wife got it yesterday. I'm getting it tomorrow. And so there will be, I think there is a future supply problem coming up in April, which will actually slow the pace here. But overall, I've got to say the pace here in the United Kingdom has been extremely good. Over 26 million people have already had the first dose. They're going to be offering everyone from 50 and over a dose. And even though the government's made a lot of mistakes last year, certainly on handling COVID-19, most people here think the National Health Service is actually doing a really good job.
The UK has been hit so hard, though. The pandemic has killed more than 125,000 people. That's the highest death toll in Europe. How do you categorize it right now? What are people saying?
It's much better. I think last year people were horrified, especially what happened in nursing homes. Essentially, the government, the hospitals inadvertently exported COVID patients into nursing homes, not knowing that was what was happening. But now daily deaths have gone from about 1,300 in late January. This is with people with COVID on their death certificates. In the earlier part of this month, down to about 140 a day. And I think that's a mixture of lockdown and vaccination campaign really beginning to pay off.
And very briefly, the lockdown happened right around a year ago. What's it like there now?
It's beginning to loosen. So two people from two different households can now meet. People are catching up. Schools and colleges are reopened. My son is back in school. And by the 29th, they're going to lift the stay-at-home rule. And maybe sometime in April, if we're lucky, the pubs open and start serving again outdoors.
NPR's Frank Langfitt speaking to us from outside London. Thanks a lot, Frank.
Happy to do it, Lisa.
There's something of a digital gold rush going on right now in the strange new world of non-fungible tokens. What is that? NFTs, non-fungible tokens, the term for digital artwork and other collectibles sold online via certificates of authenticity on the blockchain. Stay with me. That's the same technology behind Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies. And like Bitcoin, NFTs have made some people a lot of money very quickly and left many more confused as to how or why. Ben Brock Johnson covers tech for Here and Now, and he hosts the podcast Endless Thread. Ben, come on in.
Hi, Peter. How are you?
I'm pretty good, thanks. I just tried to explain what an NFT is, but I think we need you.
I thought you did pretty well. I mean, technically, it stands for Nice Fancy Tacos, which is also the name of my band. Of course, it stands for non-fungible tokens, as you mentioned. The real key phrase here may be non-fungible, as in it can't be replaced by another token, like a dollar could be replaced with another dollar or storage of value. An NFT is at its core really just part of a set of digital information that is fundamentally unique from all other sets of digital information. And it's connected to one of the underlying technologies of cryptocurrency, which you mentioned. And of course, all of this stuff is pretty esoteric and techie. But cryptocurrencies use something called blockchain, which is a kind of shared history of the transfer of digital money. But if we wanted to kind of explain it simply without going too far down that rabbit hole of cryptocurrency, we could just say that NFTs are a way to prove that something digital is the original copy, whether that's a digital photo, painting, piece of music, something else. You can basically mint the original copy, applying the necessary data to create an NFT for it, and then you can sell that image's signature data or that artwork's signature data on a number of marketplaces that have popped up.
If you buy one of these, what do you own?
It's a great question. And I guess it depends a little bit on how we define ownership in the digital world, right? But I think you can sort of think of an NFT as a signed copy of something. Maybe you don't own the copy itself because it's basically ones and zeros stored on a computer, but it's your set of ones and zeros, Peter. And say, for instance, I was a digital artist. I made a floating 3D animation of the words Here and Now that was inside of a speech bubble coming from a cartoon cat, but the cat's face was Peter O'Dowd's face.
If I put that on
the internet, people can copy and paste it, sure. But if I connected the picture to an NFT and you bought that NFT, then you'd be able to prove that you're the only holder of the one true copy.
I see, but you as the owner couldn't necessarily charge me for, say, looking at it on the internet, could you?
No, not at all. And that's one of the interesting things about this. You know, it could be copied ad infinitum, even if you can prove that you have the only original copy.
Okay, help me understand who's doing this and why. Maybe people heard the story that there's a man who paid more than $69 million for an NFT of a digital collage by the artist Beeple, or the band Kings of Leon just released their latest album using NFTs. So how is this working in the real world, if you want to call it that?
Yeah, so first thing I should say, $69 million for a digital piece of artwork, nice. It could be a good thing, right? Like all kinds of artists can essentially allow people to invest in their artwork in the digital world. That could be really good because raising money for art in the digital world has been a tricky proposition. There's a bit of a frenzy going on with NFTs right now. William Shatner has been selling Shatner-themed digital trading cards. The DJ Deadmau5 did this as well. One of the members of Linkin Park sold music as NFTs. Tons of people, both serious artists and Logan Paul, are experimenting with NFTs as a kind of way to create digital scarcity and make money off of that scarcity. There's a lot of different applications.
But $69 million for a digital collage sounds almost dangerous, right? I mean, like, is it a craze? Is it a bubble? Should people be concerned?
I mean, a lot of this stuff is a craze, you know. But I will say, like, about 5 years ago, I talked to an art collector who is floating this idea that cryptocurrencies, and specifically this underlying technology, blockchain, could actually help artists protect their work. The art world has always suffered from counterfeits, right? And online, being able to make money from your art is so hard because you make an image, you put it online, people can just copy and paste it And so to me, while there's all this kind of frenzy around, you know, buying what are essentially Pokemon cards with millions of dollars right now, to me, this is the real promise of NFTs, not the trading card factor, but the way to say, hey, I made this. This is the original copy. And I, the creator and the owner, that I think could be at some point somewhat revolutionary.
What other cautions or criticisms are out there that we should know about?
So connected to what I was just talking about, some people are concerned about this NFT gold rush because there are organizations that are effectively minting a bunch of art in the public domain with NFTs. So taking old art and applying an NFT to a digital copy and selling that. And to some, that kind of looks like copyright fraud. But there's another issue here, which is the massive computing power it takes to make all of this work. Massive amounts of computing power means massive amounts of actual power use, which means a growing and pretty concerning environmental impact. You know, that's something that William Shatner might not be worried about, but the aspirational hero that he plays on TV, Captain Kirk, I think would be worried about that.
Well, let's leave it there. Ben Brock Johnson covers tech for Here and Now and hosts the podcast Endless Thread. Ben, I feel kind of old talking to you about this. I'm not even that old.
Me too, man. But it's going to be okay.
Well, thanks for your support. Appreciate it. Take care.
Bye.
Support for Here and Now and the following message come from Zooty. Why spend months coding when you can build powerful, customized applications in days? Zooty offers an affordable solution to build apps for your business, apps that integrate into all your current systems and data sources. And your Zooty subscription always includes unlimited apps and unlimited users. Learn more at Zooty.com.
On NPR's Consider This podcast, we don't just help you keep up with the news, we help you make sense of what's happening. Like what the case about George Floyd's killing means for the ongoing fight for racial justice, or how to best navigate a pandemic that's changed life for all of us. All of that in 15 minutes every weekday. Listen now to Consider This from NPR.
It's been 1 year since Chile announced its first COVID-19 case, and now the South American country is battling a second wave of the virus. The country has 19 million people, and as of yesterday, recorded more than 900,000 cases and 22,000 deaths. But the news is not all bad, because while countries including Brazil and Argentina have vaccinated about 4% of their adult population, Chile has vaccinated 25%. And that puts it alongside Israel, the United Kingdom, and the United Arab Emirates as one of the top countries in the world for vaccination rates. Ashlyn Lang is a Reuters senior correspondent in Santiago. Welcome to Here and Now.
Hi there. Thanks for having me.
Nice to have you here. And it's certainly good news from Chile. What the country has done is really impressive. It started vaccinating healthcare workers back in December with the Pfizer vaccine and has come a long way. Tell us how it's gone so well.
I mean, I think it's a sort of lucky confluence of circumstances. You know, Chile, like many other countries, saw sort of early on in the pandemic the potential risk to its vaccine supplies. You know, its health minister told me how they had to sort of sneak supplies in from other countries, keep their flight plans secret, send military planes to sort of protect the stocks that they'd ordered and were bringing down to Chile. So they saw early on they were going to have to be very judicious in the way that they obtained vaccines. Chile has some really great trade ties. You know, it's the world's biggest copper producer. It supplies salmon and fresh fruit and vegetables all around the world. So it kind of really exploited those established trade ties to lock in deals early with producers such as China, such as the UK. Also, you know, Chile's centre-right President Piñera was sort of coming off the back of some really intense social protests. And this was his moment to shine. This was what he was good at. He has good international contacts. He's a billionaire businessman, and he really exploited them to full effect.
But when you talk about the way things are secreted into the country, does that mean they got them from the black market? Why did it have to be so much under the cover of darkness to get PPE and to get some vaccine doses?
Well, we saw some incidents early on in the pandemic where countries were complaining that stocks of supplies, not through the black market, but they were buying legitimately, were being kind of hijacked on the tarmac by other countries. I think the United States was mentioned on one occasion. There was some quite rough practices in obtaining these desperately needed supplies from around the world. And so countries became very protective about how they obtained those supplies and brought them into their countries. But no, certainly no suggestion of any sort of black market deals.
So the president used his contacts very deftly. What about the vaccine rollout plan? How did the country manage to get access to enough vaccine and then to distribute it enough to a country as large as Chile with some very remote places there?
Yeah, well, I mean, Chile did very well to secure an early deal with Pfizer. So by the time the second vaccine that they had ordered from Sinovac, whose trial they hosted in country, arrived, they were able to then start rolling that out in a massive vaccination program to its elderly population and then to teachers.
This is the Chinese vaccine.
This is the Chinese vaccine, Sinovac. They've ordered 60 million doses to cover 3 years. They paid for the trial themselves with the support of the business community. So again, they locked in that early relationship, which has borne fruit.
So again, the government played its hand pretty well there. But in the day-to-day distribution of the vaccines, how did it get out to so many people? Because a quarter of the country has been vaccinated now.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, what the WHO representative here says is that it was just a really good pulling together of the academic community, the health community, and the political community to make sure that the vaccines were put out very quickly. In Chile, there is a little bit of mistrust in authority, probably a legacy of those protests. And so they tried to be very transparent about how they were doing things. There's a website that's updated daily showing where vaccines are going. You know, Chile has a very good network of public health clinics, and it has a very long established vaccination program. I think looking, you know, some of the really remote regions have actually had a higher rollout of vaccines proportionately, sort of percentage wise, than actually the capital itself. So I think they've done well on that as well.
I want to ask you about a couple of things that we know very much about Chile. One, and you mentioned this, copper-based innovation in Chile. I wonder if that has been affected because of the coronavirus. And secondly, the wine industry. We certainly get a lot of Chilean wine up here.
Yes, and I can assure you that people in quarantine in Chile have been really making the most of the Chilean wine industry. The vineyards have been open. They are obviously restricted in terms of how many people they can receive. And the copper price has spiked, and that's been really important for Chile because it means that it's been getting more money into its coffers to fund these massive social programs that it's needed to support people who have been out of work. Another interesting thing to note about Chile's copper industry is it's known for really important antiviral effects. Actually, it's been shown to kill viruses, including the coronavirus, much quicker than on other surfaces. So that's a kind of burgeoning Chilean industry now, which is really quite interesting. They're even putting it in their banknotes, putting it in threading and clothing. So that's quite an interesting sideline that's come out of this. I guess every cloud has a silver lining.
Well, thank you very much for telling us about what's happening there. Ashlyn Lang, Reuters senior correspondent in Santiago, Chile. Thank you.
Thank you so much. It's been great.
Miami Herald readers lost a fixture this week when Carl Hiaasen wrote his final column for the paper after 35 years. Hiaasen began at the Herald as a young reporter back in the late 70s. But if, like us, you're a fan of his writing, don't worry, he's still going to be working on novels. His latest, Squeeze Me, was a bestseller. And as he says in his last column, he'll never stop writing about his bent, beautiful, and infuriating state. Carl Hiaasen joins us now on Skype. Carl, welcome back to Here and Now.
It's good to be here.
And congratulations, I should say, on a beautiful career. How does it feel? No, really, how does it feel?
It's a strange feeling. My work week was always anchored around the column I wrote for the Herald, and now that anchor is gone. So the question is, do I have enough self-discipline to continue the rest of my writing, or does it all fall apart?
And what do you think? Do you?
I will find out. Ask me in a year.
Well, here's what I don't understand. You know, you're a famous novelist. Why did you bother with the newspaper job for so many years?
Well, as I'm speaking with you now, it's the first time since, God, I went into the business when I was 21 that I don't have a day job. You know, I mean, I always hung on to my newspaper job, and the Herald was obviously the longest one. And I just felt like that was legitimate. I mean, I was gonna get paid for doing that, but you don't know that with novels. I mean, the public's attention span is short, their appetite can be short. But I also felt, and I'm not joking when I say this, an obligation, because, you know, I was born and raised down here in Florida, and I felt lucky to be able to to write for what was sort of my hometown newspaper. I grew up in the Lauderdale area, but I grew up reading the Herald. And the idea that I could still work there and still be relevant and still be able to weigh in was important to me. And the other thing was, you know, the jolt you get from journalism, daily journalism, it's a completely different kind of high. You know, you write a book, you finish a novel, and there's sort of a gestation period before it actually shows up, you know, in print. And it could be 9 months, could be a year, could be a little shorter. But, well, you know, you write the column and bang, it's in the paper. And it's that instant shot, you know, that instant adrenaline shot. And I didn't want to give that up.
Oh, I hear you. I hear you for sure. Why don't we talk about Florida? Because your home state really is at the center, not only of your novels, but also of your columns, of course. How much has it changed in the decades since your career
started? Oh, my God. You know, since I've been there, I mean, about 1,000 people a day move to Florida still. And I don't know how many depart one way or another, either spiritually or in U-Hauls. So I don't know what the net gain is. Imagine a country growing that much and by that many millions. So the upheaval, you know, sort of the collision of cultures and all the national news issues that are at the forefront nationally now. I mean, they really started here, including the immigration issue. I remember in 1980, you know, as a reporter in the Mariel boat lift, you know, I mean, 250,000 people arrived within a couple of weeks on the shores of Florida. And of course, the drugs, narcotics, that kind of, and the gun violence, so many national issues. And then, of course, the political issues. I mean, look at 2000, you know, Gore versus Bush or Bush versus Gore. I forget who versus what, but it was a, you know, it was a cluster, and it was put on display for the whole country to see how dysfunctional Florida was.
It is kind of a unique place, isn't it? I mean, for some reason, you've kind of become known for mining the bizarre Florida man stories that come out of the state. We got a few of them together here before we talk to you. Florida man tries to burn down ex-boyfriend's house with spaghetti sauce. Titusville grandmother pops out teeth to scare off nude man on back porch. why is Florida so odd?
You know, I mean, I think it's a place that people flood into. I mean, they just pour into this place from all over. I mean, you know, you have the retirees from the north, you have the Midwesterners who come down here, then you've got the Caribbean migration. And then, I mean, just like about 3 days ago, someone sent me a story, and it might have been Dave Barry who sent my story. I don't know.
Your friend, yeah.
They tried to fix the homecoming queen election at a school in Pensacola. The assistant principal allegedly hacked into the system and added 100 plus votes for her own daughter to win homecoming queen. I mean, it was literally stop the steal. And I just thought it was hilarious because it's in Matt Gaetz's backyard. And where was he when we needed him? And
the congressman, yeah.
You know, you see these stories, and Dave and I joke about this. We don't even have to look at the dateline. We know it's Florida just from the headline.
But, you know, it's also a beautiful place, and it's in peril. Yeah. That's a theme that you've written quite a bit about over the years. And as you look back on that, do you think you've made any difference on that front? And do you feel like Florida's environment is in good hands?
The answer to the question is no. Anything that's in the hands of the Florida legislature is in slippery hands. And the point whether I made a difference or not, I think anybody who goes into journalism thinking that they're personally going to win a crusade or make a difference is fooling themselves. What you're trying to do is give voice to other people who feel the same way. Let them know they're not the only ones who feel that way and shine a spotlight on important things. And I will say this, that in the time I've started in this business until now, when I first started, as I said in the last column I wrote, no politician ever talked about the Everglades. Nobody pretended to care about the Everglades. And now, if you run for office, not even national office, and you come through Florida, you better have some rhapsodizing to do about the beauty and importance of the Everglades, because it is an apple pie front burner issue now. And that wasn't the case when I was young. So that's changed for the best. But in general, you know, the rape and pillaging of the state by the engine of greed that keeps the state running is still just as strong now as it always has been.
You use the word pillaging, which reminds me of your final column on journalism, the state of journalism right now. You're leaving at a time when, you know, local newsrooms have just been gutted. Yeah. And there's a question about what it even means to report the facts anymore. There was just a capital insurrection, questions that are totally false about election fraud. Where do you leave journalism right now?
Well, I mean, I worry for readers, those of us that are you know, are retiring or leaving after long, we'll be fine. What I worry about are readers who depend on their local newspapers and media for hometown reporting. What's going on at the zoning board meeting? What's going on at the sewage board meeting? All of a sudden your property taxes went up. How did that happen? Because we don't have enough boots on the ground to cover all the stuff that we used to cover. So people are now finding out about things that changed their lives after the fact and after it's too late to do anything about it. That, I think, is a very sad and troublesome thing. And it's part of it is the economy. Part of it is sort of the internet, what that's done to the, you know, the business model of journalism. And I don't know the answer to that, but I do know that it's very popular to sit here, you can't stand the local paper. Who cares if they go out of business? And then there's a fire at the end of your street and you run out there and the fire truck goes by and nobody's telling you anything and whose house is burning and how did it happen? Yeah. Things that you would have gotten from your local media now. Then all of a sudden it's important to be getting information, you know, when the fire breaks out.
Would you encourage young people to get into the business now?
If they care, I would encourage it. I would never say to them, oh, this is a very prosperous, booming industry to be in. Of course not. The question is, where are they going to land? What is going to be the media platform? What is going to be the landscape for them to be able to do the job, which is simply you go out and get the facts and you get it to the readers. And that's, you know, democracy can't function with an uninformed, you know, population that's just daily under barrage from just nut jobs and conspiracy lunatics. It just can't function like that. You have to have a safe place to go to get real facts.
I'm going to let you go, but first, your buddy, the writer, Dave Barry, who you've already talked about here, said in his column, acknowledging your retirement, said, in all the time I've spent with Carl, I have never known him to not be pissed off about something, which I thought was great and suits you as a journalist and a columnist, right? But what are you going to be pissed off about as you sail off into the sunset?
Probably all the same things. I mean, the environment, the political corruption that we have, all the same things that piss me off and have since I was a kid. And I'm not going to stop writing. And I have plenty of opportunities to vent. Once you stop being pissed off is when you stop caring, you know, when you've given up and you've walked away. And I'm not doing that. That's never going to happen. Even if I have to somehow master some aspect of the social media to keep it going, I'll do it because Florida is too important. And what's happening here is happening all over the country. This is just, you know, a microcosm of what the whole country's going through right now. So, yeah, it's important. And, yeah, you got to stay pissed off.
Well, plus, I'm sure your fans are looking forward to your next novel, which I think is coming soon. So we'll keep an eye out on that. Author Thanks. And now former Miami Herald columnist Carl Hiaasen. Carl, it's great to talk to you. Congratulations and good luck with the future.
Yeah, thanks again, Peter. We'll talk again, I bet.
I hope so.
Take care.
Today, President Biden and Vice President Harris are in Atlanta to try to help a grieving community. Tuesday, a white gunman opened fire on three massage spas there. He killed 8 people, most of them women of Asian descent. We're still learning about the victims. Investigators, as of today, have released all their names. They are Soon Park, who is 74 years old. Hyun Grant was 51. Soon-Chak Kim was 69. Young Yue was 63. Delena Ashley Yan was 33, Paul Andre Michaels was 54 years old, and Dao Yong Feng was 44. Also, Xiao Shei Tan was 49 years old. She was one of the owners of the businesses. Romina Ruiz Goriana is a reporter with USA Today and has spoken with Tan's family, has more about a vigil that took place. Romina, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
So yesterday would have been Tan's 50th birthday. You met her family at the church and at the vigil. Tell us what they told you.
So, you know, I have been reporting this story remotely, but my colleague Trevor Hughes, who was on site, we have both been interviewing and speaking with the family. It was an incredibly difficult day. You know, it was a day in which they expected to be having strawberry fresh cream cake, and instead they were organizing flower arrangements and what kind of service they're going to have. The family is actually deeply Catholic and was very religious. And I think one of the things that was most moving is that at the end of the day, when they went back to the business where this vigil was going to take place, nobody knew who they were, and they were grieving in silence, you know?
Nobody knew who they were because they didn't really make themselves prominent. But as you say, at one point, a bystander brought up a pamphlet in support of the women and put it in the hands of the daughter.
Correct. I think what we saw is a sense of collective grief, right? So I think people, even without asking themselves, who is this person? What is your name? There was a sense of solidarity and of grief.
And you spoke to Tan's daughter this morning. Her name is Jamie Webb. Here's how she remembers her mother.
My mom's a very strong woman. She is very determined. And also, she's very loving and caring. I mean, she's the best mom anyone can hope for, I guess.
Could you tell us about Xiaoxie Tan's background, how she came to the U.S.?
Well, it's actually a love story. Xiaoxie was actually fell in love with Michael Webb. He was an American contractor in southern China. And even though there was this language barrier, they fell in love. He fell in love with her. And he also fell in love with Jamie, who couldn't have been more than 11 or 12 years old at the time. And they courted each other, traveling all over China, had this wonderful wedding. And a year and a half later, he moved his new family to Florida, to the United States. And they were incredibly, incredibly, incredibly close. And I know that I have super emphasized that. And they sound, from having spoken to Michael Webb and from having spoken to Jamie, even though they eventually separated, they remained a family. And she would say that we family. She would say that all the time, even after getting divorced, because as Michael Webb told me, that's what they were.
Xiaoxie Tan's mother is elderly. She still lives in China. Does she know that her daughter is dead?
No, she does not. At this point in time, the only thing that they've told her is that her daughter misplaced her phone. They would speak every day, and they've just told her that Tan misplaced and lost her phone, and that's why she hasn't been in touch. They actually even celebrated, you know, singing happy birthday and without knowing that she has passed.
Romina, what can you tell us about the other victims of the shootings?
Unfortunately, we still don't have a lot of information. It's been incredibly challenging to reach family members and neighbors and people who knew them. And I can imagine it's also incredibly taxing because they're so grief-stricken. At USA Today, we have spoken to the families of three of the victims, two of them besides Tan. We were also able to track down the family of Alcias Hernandez Ortiz, who is the sole survivor. He was actually on his way to send remittances at this store right next to Young's Asian Spa. And we spoke to his wife. They're originally from Guatemala, and he's been in Georgia for approximately a decade. You know, he's stable, but he's still in the ICU, and he's set to have surgery next week, his wife told me, so that they remove the bullet from his abdomen. So we still are trying to find out as much as we can and are very interested in learning who these people were.
Well, thank you very much for your reporting and for speaking with us. Romina Ruiz-Goriena, a reporter with USA Today. Thanks a lot, Romina.
Thank you.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Lisa Mullins.
And I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now.